Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. This week's show is going to be absolutely off the charts. I can't wait. We have three guests joining us today: Andrew Hinterleiter from the Asexuality and Visibility Educational Network. We have Jordan Harbinger, who's a dating coach that's going to be coming on to talk to us about social hacking. Then we're going to end up our show with Jason Harley, who's returning to talk about the separation between parents and the bedroom. So let's not waste any time. Let's get the show started with our dating news of the week. Okay, I talk a lot about the costs of dating. And when I'm talking about these costs, you know, I often talk about the emotional costs with dating. We put ourselves out there to people. We share things about ourselves. You know, when women are trying to meet many men, they're often spending a lot of money on the clothes that they wear or their makeup. I have one friend who always calls me before she goes on a date, sends me a picture of herself, and sends me also pictures of the lipstick and eyeshadow choices of what she's going to wear. You would not believe the extent that women go to. I have another friend who goes on a lot of first dates. In fact, after she broke up with her boyfriend this past December, she's been on like 83 or so dates with a bunch of different guys, mostly first dates. She sort of follows my approach of the employment model: determine whether the applicant is successful. If not, reject or accept on the first date. But she has all of these different outfits depending on the number of dates that she goes out with. So she's got three or four first date outfits that she has. She's got a couple second dates. And then as the number goes down, the number of outfit options that she has becomes fewer because there are fewer men that she goes out with on multiple dates. But this isn't the cost of dating that I'm talking about today. I'm talking about the financial cost of dating. So there was this really, really interesting article that came out this week talking about a recent study that's been released by a sociologist at Chapman University named David Frederick. And Professor Frederick is really interested in who's paying for what on a date. And we know that dating is expensive. I talk to male friends and listeners of the show all the time about how much money they're spending on dates. In fact, I mean, I talked to one listener who told me, you know, I have to limit myself to three dates a week because it's becoming really, really pricey. So let's think about it. Who's paying for the date, a man or a woman? According to this survey that was conducted by Professor Frederick, 84% of men and 58% of women say that the men are primarily paying for the dates. 57% of women, however, are offering to pay for the dates, but 39% of these women are hoping that the men would pay. What's funny about this is that I often find that when a woman doesn't like a man, she's more likely to offer to pay so that she doesn't feel obligated to provide any type of sexual favors at the end of the date. 44% of women were bothered, however, when men expected them to contribute financially to the date. But I think what's more interesting and points to many social changes that are happening in today's economy with regards to the precarious nature of male jobs and the difficulty men and women are both having in establishing themselves financially is that men are saying that they want more help. In fact, 64% of men say that they would like for the woman to contribute to the date. And 44% of the men say that they would drop the woman like she was hot if she doesn't offer to pay, even if she might, in fact, be really, really hot. So this is interesting to think about. How does this affect social change? You know, women are in the labor force participating in equal rates as men. Women are out earning graduate degrees and college degrees relative to their male counterparts. But there's still this last holdout for traditional social norms when it comes to dating. Will women still want to be treated in a chivalrous manner? And I think that's really, really, really interesting. Who should be paying on the date? Does it depend on whether or not you like the person? As I said before, should women who don't like the men offer to pay on the date? Who's wealthier? Is the man wealthier or is the woman? Is the male still in graduate school and the woman has a job already? If the man's older and has more resources, should he be paying? These are all questions that we need to think about. Another interesting issue, however, is whether or not this pattern would persist over the course of a relationship. So if you're setting the precedent of the guy's always paying, it could be kind of problematic because theoretically the woman might never try to contribute to the relationship financially. Or maybe they need to develop some type of exchange. Maybe the woman bakes the man macaroons and massages his back for an hour every night. Maybe that's a way that she can contribute to a relationship when she has a partner that's financially more successful than her at the moment. All interesting things to think about. Let me know on my Facebook page, Hook Up with Dr. Jess. Okay, so speed dating sites. I talk about these sites all the time. So we talked about a couple weeks ago that really crazy site on speed dating in New York where women and men had to sort of fit these standards of attractiveness. Well, let's say women more so than men. They had the skinny mini event where women had to be a size 8 or below to go, which I found to be pretty interesting, and so did many of our listeners who came and gave me feedback. And they also had the cougar, or as we say on Hook Up with Dr. Jess, the Wildcat boy toy event in which older women and younger men come together and try to mix and mingle. And I talked a couple weeks ago about this new dating service in London, which I thought to be an epic fail, in which people were not actually allowed to speak on the dates and had to communicate through grunting or making some verbal or other hand signals. So while there was no speaking on this date, I think that that's pretty interesting, but the one site that I found today might even be even a bit more interesting. So I don't think many people like blind dates, and I often feel like people date sort of blindly, ignoring everything else, but in this speed dating company, you really are dating blindly, or at least you're blindfolded. So there's this new company in Charlotte called Outside of the Box, which holds these speed dating events. And the individuals at these events are blindfolded. I kid you not. You cannot see the face of the person with whom you're interacting. The goal of this, according to the people in Outside the Box, is to make individuals more sensitive to other things that might be important in determining a partner, like their smell, the inflection in their voice, or the tone in their voice. These are all things that we can think about when we're dating and we should be thinking about. But according to the people at Outside the Box, maybe people are just thinking about how sexy that guy looks or the cut of that woman's dress and how it highlights her bosom. But we don't really know if this Outside of the Box idea will be successful. You can't pick up on body language, which I think is a really critical thing when you're assessing somebody to date. You also don't, you know, potentially talk about other things other than the fact that you don't see the person. Are you going to ask them how they look? You still might be focusing on that physical characteristic because you can't really see it. So let's see how this plays out. Okay, I got this amazing story today. My mother sent me an email. My parents are, well, at least my mother is, a huge dog lover. You would not believe it. My mother loves her dogs, Samson and Delilah. They're Bernese Mountain Dogs. They're gorgeous. Samson weighs 160 pounds. And my mother spends thousands of dollars on the dogs. You have no idea. But I wonder if she would agree with this article that she sent me. The question of the article is, do you date like your animals? I'm not kidding. So there was a study done by Canadian users of Match.com, and the findings of this study are really, really interesting. I've never dated a man with any animals, per se, but I don't think I'll ever date a man with a cat, ever, because according to this study, cat lovers are real cheapskates. Compared to dog lovers who spend about $40 or $50 on a date, cat lovers only spend $10 to $20. Clearly, I need to stick with men who like dogs. But as my mother says, the reason that I have not been successful in my prior relationships is that I've never dated a man with a dog, so we need to think about this a little more. Another interesting fact that came out of this study is that 53% of people who do not have pets don't drink on a first date. They didn't really explore this much, but I'm really curious about as to why they didn't. Maybe they're not stressed out about their dogs or cats, and therefore they don't feel like they need a cocktail at the end of the evening. I'm not really sure. So it's interesting to think about whether or not you're a pet person and whether or not that's something important when you're dating. I mean, we know that John Cusack movie says you must love dogs. But dog lovers are really interesting because dog lovers are more likely to have one-night stands. And the psychologist who conducted the study said that people who are dog lovers like instant gratification. That's why they have a dog. They receive immediate affection from their dogs. So maybe they want the same thing from people. Maybe I need to stay away from dog men. Maybe I need to just continue to date men who don't own pets. I'm not sure. So an interesting thing about petless people, though, is that they're less likely to believe in soulmates. And while I might like dogs, I think dogs are great, I certainly do believe in soulmates. So that's something to really think about. But the larger issue transcending this study is, do people's pet relationships translate into their larger love life? Dog lovers are found to be more generous. Cat lovers are found to be lower maintenance. This is based upon the time and energy it takes to have a dog or cat. I wonder what happens when a cat person and a dog person get together, or a pet person and a non-pet person get together. We'll have to think about this more. All right. Don't reuse, don't recycle. That's my mantra. I always say it. I'm an EPA supporter, but not in this relationship department. But there are researchers at the University of Arizona who think that reusing and recycling in prior relationships might not be a bad thing, at least not for divorced couples. So 82% of individuals who are going through a divorce communicate following their breakup, and 21% have sex with each other following the breakup. They say that sex can be beneficial with an ex, especially those who have yet to accept the divorce. And for those who have accepted the divorce, there's really no effect that they found. But I think that what's interesting is that they're saying that the breakups cause a void in individuals. They feel left out of an attachment relationship, so they try to find sex as a means to fill that void and create some type of attachment. I've always said that this might be a bad idea, especially for women, because women experience bonding during sex when they release the hormone oxytocin. So the idea of bonding with a person that you have had sex with historically and had a long-term relationship, including marriage, just seems really baffling to me. Follow Dr. Jess's advice. Don't reuse. Don't recycle. Don't rebound either. Go through your marriage. Go through counseling. And go from there. That's the healthy way to do it. Don't reuse. Don't recycle. All right. That's my dating news of the week, lovers and friends. I'll be right back with the Hollywood Report. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess. And you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. So, apparently, Billy Joel's ex is always a woman. Well, except maybe not him. Will Arnett, who recently split with his ex of many years, is seeing more than the Garden of Eden. He's seeing Billy Joel's ex, Katie, who's apparently a chef. So let's see what happens with the Arrested Development star and Billy Joel's ex. Maybe this will inspire a new song. Okay, so Disney star and former actress Raven Simone recently came out as being a lesbian on Twitter, and this has caused a lot of controversy for many networks that she's been on, including Disney, which is considered a family network. But Raven's doing just more than sharing her sexual identity on Twitter, and we're hoping that many people will come to accept her for her sexual identity, and that she can be a good role model for young people, and that's one of her goals. But she's also talking about her love life on Twitter, which I find to be really interesting. Recently, she wrote that she said, "I love you," to Ari Lennox on Twitter. So people are now saying that Raven and Ari are involved. We'll have to see. Maybe I can talk to Ari, and she can give me the real scoop. Okay, so he really might be into her. Yes, Justin Long and Amanda Seyfried are together. Amanda Seyfried actually is the lookalike of one of my best friends from Emory. It's really, really funny. I just can't wait to get them in the same room together. I don't know if Justin Long's her type, though. I'll have to ask her. He's not my physical type at all, but ever since I saw Ed, the TV show that was on NBC when I was in high school, and he played Warren Cheswick, who is sort of this bumbling young kid, I absolutely adored him. I thought he was the best. But he's been recently linked to Amanda Seyfried, and they were seen together at the Lovelace premiere. And rumor has it that they've known each other for a really long time and are trying to see where it's going to go. I'm hoping that there will be wedding bells and that their relationship will be less complicated than the movies that they've starred in, like He's Just Not Into You, Mamma Mia, Les Miserables, Dear John, and The Breakup. Okay. That's the Hollywood Report. I'm going to play some music, and then we're going to get back with Andrew Hinderleiter. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today, we have Andrew Hinderleiter, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and involved with the Asexuality and Visibility Educational Network called AVEN. And we're here today to have him talk with us about asexuality generally. I saw this really interesting article in The Atlantic and wanted to explore it further because I really don't know much about asexuality relative to other topics with regards to human sexuality. And I thought it would be really great to have an expert with us today to talk about it. Welcome, Andrew. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me and having me on the show.
Oh, great. So, Andrew, I was really curious. When I was reading this article, I've had so many questions. What exactly is asexuality?
So, people will define it differently, but definitely the most commonly accepted definition is that asexuals are people who do not experience sexual attraction. So, it's different from celibacy, which is about behavior. Where asexuality is usually seen as a sexual orientation rather than behavior.
So it's related to sexual orientation. Most definitions of sexuality, from what you're saying, are related to sexual orientation rather than behavior, but asexuality is completely and totally related to refraining from sex.
So one issue that's talked about is that typically people think of celibacy or abstinence, but what they have in mind is this idea of refraining from sex. And very often, there's this assumption that, you know, people are interested in it, and they're restraining their desires. And so that's one reason why many asexuals are very hesitant to use the term celibacy or abstinence, because they don't want that assumption that there is this interest. The other, it's people aren't interested in it, and often don't have sex, but they might.
I see. So they may have sex, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So, but people have sex for all kinds of reasons. Curiosity, some of those reasons involve interested in sex, but there are lots of other reasons too, right? And so sometimes asexuals will have sex to please a partner because they're curious or for one of different reasons.
Interesting. So you're saying that individuals who are asexual might be in committed relationships with other people?
Yeah, sometimes they are.
Okay.
The research that we have so far suggests the percentage of asexuals who are in long-term relationships is lower than the general population, but there certainly are a number of asexuals who are in committed relationships.
Interesting. So individuals who are asexual might theoretically be sort of closeted to a certain degree, or at least, and that might be part of the mission of your organization, from what you're saying.
Yes. One difficulty that a lot of people had is that there has not been, until very recently, much public awareness about this. And so many people, they might feel sort of weird or different, but they didn't have any term to call themselves or any way of talking to other people with similar experiences. And so one of the main goals of AVEN, the Asexual Visibility Education Network, is to promote visibility and education about asexuality.
Okay. So why do individuals choose to identify as asexual, or is it a choice?
Well, so as with sexual orientation in general, who you're attracted to is not a choice. But the question is how you're going to identify does involve some degree of choice. Mm-hmm. And so the situation with asexual audience is the same. So why people identify as asexual is something that I'm currently doing some research on. And the main reason is that they feel that the definition, a person who does not experience sexual attraction, fits them fairly well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And of course, there are other reasons involved, as with any question of how to identify.
Mm-hmm. So, approximately how many individuals in the U.S. are asexual, and what are their demographic characteristics? You said that there was far lower numbers of asexuals relative to the general population, but do we know much about them?
We don't, because the low visibility in the general population has meant it's not often been included in the big research samples. And so the best data we have is from a couple large surveys from the UK. And there, one of the surveys from 1990 suggested about 1% of the population is asexual. And then another more recently came up with a smaller number.
So, I'm sorry, could you repeat that? 1% of the population, according to the survey, was asexual? Is that what you said?
Yeah, so according to a UK survey in 1990, about 1%, although the number was substantially lower in a follow-up survey from the UK in 2000.
Interesting.
The corresponding American survey didn't have an option to correspond to asexuals,
Got
so
it.
We don't really know.
Interesting. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I was curious, how do people often explain their choice to family and friends with whom they're involved? Or people with whom they're involved, why that they're asexual?
Well, so why they're asexual, I mean, who knows? As for why they identify as asexual, often it's because they feel it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that, actually explains them. But how they're going to explain things to their family or friends, it's going to depend on what the people's question is, I think. But in general, it's something some people do tell their family and friends about it, some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the person.
Okay. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today, and I look forward to talking with you in the future. Have a great day now.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, y'all, that was Andrew Hinterlader talking to us about asexuality. Now we're going to play some music and then come back with Jordan Harbinger. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today, I'm really excited to introduce Jordan Harbinger, who is a dating coach at The Art of Charm, and who recently had an article written about him, about his foray into the world of social hacking. Jordan, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. So, Jordan, I wanted to talk with you about this article because I was incredibly fascinated. Apparently, you sort of penetrated the world of defense contractors and were able to gain all of this information. And your background is particularly interesting to me because it's quite varied and very accomplished. You've been a lawyer and now run a successful business helping to teach men how to date. What made you become interested in this social engineering space, though?
Well, when I was a kid, I actually was really bored, and so I actually started to wiretap when I was real young.
Oh, wow.
And that gave me insight into a lot of, I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations has passed on it, so I'm not too worried about it.
Yes, that's a good thing.
I think that, that gave me insight into a lot of people's personal lives. There was a neighbor that was getting divorced, and, I remember thinking, wow, I'm hearing this guy talk to his ex-wife, his friend, his mom, and I'm hearing him kind of bare his soul to different people. So I started to get a real interesting insight into human dynamics, and that really got me interested in social engineering. Not to mention that I was using some of the techniques and hacks to gain access to phone systems in the first place. So it was a pretty interesting sort of incline just from learning about technical aspects of phone systems and things like that, and then parlaying that into social hacking, which became my focus. I always loved hacking, but I was less technically inclined than socially inclined.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, when you said this, I'm thinking about Edward Snowden right now, and so glad that you're not in Russia, but rather on the phone with me right now.
Me too. I don't think people will go, hey, man, you're the next Edward Snowden. And I'm like, no, that guy made a big mistake.
Agreed.
I'm not exactly in that same
caliber. Absolutely. So what exactly did you do? Because the article did a really good job of laying this out. You essentially contacted and interacted these defense contractors, but you did it in a really creative way.
What I did was make sure that they trusted me. I didn't do anything illegal, actually. The only activity that was done that got any sort of confidential information was allow them to divulge their own secrets. So I didn't pose as a federal agent. I didn't lie about much. I didn't lie about qualifications or anything. I just let people make assumptions based on other assumptions and other trust building and rapport.
Mm-hmm.
I let them divulge their own secrets. So basically made friends with people, tricked them using social media, got information using the internet to make them think I knew more about them than I did, and allowed them to fill in the blank, and then sort of started putting the puzzle together.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did that was, one, to up the challenge for myself as a social hacker, but two, to show that if I was able to do that without blatantly breaking any laws and without making any bold statements or lies or posing as anyone else, what if somebody with no scruples and an actual budget and a lot more time, because bear in mind, most of this was done in one afternoon, imagine what they could do. I mean, there's entire organizations in every major country whose sole job is to do this kind of thing.
Of course. So, but Jordan, I think that one of the interesting aspects of it was that you posted a picture of a woman who was very attractive as a means by which to sort of bait these men. And I thought that was rather...
That
was rather strategic of
that
you.
That was one of the things that I did. Yeah, that was one of the things that I did. And a lot of people really took issue with that on the articles. You could see the comments on some of the articles online. They were like, this would never work on me. And then some of the more self-aware types were like, this would totally work on me. I would 100% want to believe that this girl likes me and tell her pretty much anything to make sure that she did. And, you know, that's the truth of the matter. I mean, you get somebody who can appeal to our sense of ego, you know, and boom, like, all defenses have been bypassed for us as men. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yes, no, that's the most interesting part, that individuals are so willing to compromise things that are incredibly sensitive to them, not only professionally, but potentially personally as well, in order to gain access to a woman. I found that to be very interesting because I would think that, in theory, wouldn't it be better to approach someone that would be safer and not necessarily reveal all of that information to? It just didn't make sense to me that people would be so, I don't know, thoughtless or careless.
Right. Except for they're not being careless. They're just weighing their priorities differently, right? Like, nobody did anything that was going to be blatantly... I guess that's up for debate, right? Some of these guys risk their jobs in their security clearance. They're careless. But really, it's not like, I don't know what I'm doing at the time. I mean, granted, they didn't know they were talking to a 33-year-old dude with a little bit of a beer belly. They didn't know that. They thought they were talking to a cute girl. But that doesn't matter, right? Like, they didn't know that at the time, but they did know exactly what they were doing. They knew what they were doing is improper. They just decided not to care because they wanted to suspend that particular logical faculty in favor of maybe I'll get this girl. And that was exactly, that was the only thing that it took for most of these guys to breach what could have been, you know, serious business, depending on who I was and depending on what they had given up and how much other information I had, and et cetera. I mean, they're lucky that I wasn't, you know, Chinese intelligence or something like that. And that's the point of the experiment, is I got a lot with a little. And I'm not malicious, but what if I were?
Absolutely. So what types of information, if you can say, and I don't want to obviously compromise any type of confidentiality you have or make you uncomfortable, but what types of information did they give you that would be particularly salient or interesting?
I mean, some of the stuff that I can mention were projects that were being sponsored by the Defense Department, certain ideas that they were being researched, projects that were being worked on, who were being worked on, where they were being worked on, by what company they were being worked on, how much money was devoted to the research of these specific projects. So one of the things that was being worked on was a missile defense system. Obviously, those are always highly confidential, highly classified.
Of course.
They're always a big deal. Another thing that was being worked on was some ballistics, missiles, aircraft was another thing. The aircraft stuff wasn't as big of a deal because it was about, you know, a plane that everybody knows we have, but still, I'm assuming that having access to the people who are working on it is not something that contractor wants everybody to know.
Of course.
There were some computer initiatives that had to do with cyber warfare, and also some battlefield technology that had to do with helping soldiers identify different units and forces on the battlefield. All of those things got discussed.
Did you?
At length.
Interesting. So did you expect people to be as forthcoming as they were with providing information regarding these sensitive issues?
Of course not. I mean, I really, initially, what I'd hoped to do was make contact with these people and thought, okay, that'll be the experiment. You know, I'll see how easy these people are to access. How easy they, and it happened so quickly that when I called the other guys at socialengineer.org, which is the website that I was giving a talk for them at DEF CON and Black Hat, when I called them, they said, wait, you're done already? How is that even possible? I explained to them, and they were shocked, and they said, hey, listen, now take a step further, but first let's call the attorneys.
Yeah.
So we called the legal team. They came back with, here's what you can do, here's the line, here's where you stop. And I said, okay, great, got it. And then I spent the rest of the afternoon going after, you know, that type of information. So I wasn't expecting it to be forthcoming. I thought, okay, I had 16 weeks to make this happen, or it was like, you know, 12 weeks or whatever it was at the time to make this happen. Mm-hmm. Instead, it took like 8 hours.
That's crazy. I wanted to also ask you, I think that this experiment points to a larger issue raised by social hacking generally and protecting one's information in an online setting. As a dating coach, how would you advise your clients to act who are using online dating? Because a lot of people reveal a great deal of information about themselves when interacting with others online.
They do. I would say, you know, you can say what company you work for. You can say where you work. I wouldn't divulge my last name online. One of the other things is get an email address that you use just for online dating. And don't let it be your corporate email address. A lot of people will use their corporate email address. That makes it really easy for people to find out other information about you. With the corporate information address, I can find out your office, where you're located, what department you work in. There's a lot of things that you can do there that you don't want. I mean, for example, and people think, oh, who cares if the guy knows where I work? Well, listen about this.
Okay.
What happens when you're dating a guy online and he turns out to be a creepy weirdo that you don't want to talk to anymore? Well, now he knows he can call you at work, he can call your colleagues, he can call your boss, and he can call and say, hi, is Jen there? Oh, no, she just left. Oh, great, so she should be on her way home right now. So you can be there waiting for you. That's creepy. That's really scary.
I don't do that,
especially as a girl.
I completely agree with you. But I also think that it's, even if you're a very intelligent person, I think that if you provide just a small amount of information about yourself and questions that are reasonable to ask in an online dating situation, like where did you go to college and what did you do, I think someone can find you in pretty much a snap almost if they're good at Googling.
Definitely. They certainly can. So what I would say is, if you think that somebody is a good catch online, you think that they're interesting, move to the phone and start talking to them, because you don't want to know. You want to know who you're talking to, and if you're talking to them, you know, there's no need to divulge a ton of information. Flirt, see if there's a good chemistry fit there in terms of the way that you flirt, interact with each other. Don't share a lot of personal information. If they want to, that's fine. And honestly, just set up the coffee date, because a lot of people who are scammers, con men, identity thieves, and that kind of thing, they'll stop there. They might not even be in your city or hometown. They might just be pretending. So stop there, and if they won't meet you in real life, well, then there's no dating potential there, and obviously you may have dodged the bullet. And further, if you meet someone in real life, women have very good intuition, way better than most guys. If you meet someone in real life at a coffee shop in public, and you go, this isn't a guy where I would say, here's all my personal information, you can find that out pretty quick. Over coffee, you don't need to have a 5-hour phone conversation and then go, geez, I just divulged a lot of information to that guy and I don't even know who he is.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, what's really interesting is that I have a male friend who dates online regularly, and he makes every woman that he's with basically tell them everything about themselves and, you know, asks for their Facebook information before even going out with them. So it's very interesting, and I think that he goes a little bit too far, but that's just my opinion.
Sure. I mean, I totally understand why he's doing that in a lot of ways, because people waste a ton of time online, and you end up meeting tons and tons of people
who are
disasters that you'd never talk to in real life. But here's the difference, right? If you're a guy or a girl, you can decide most of what you need to know about somebody in just a few minutes. So
in person.
What you need to do is look in person.
Right? Yes.
Exactly. So look at their pictures online. Are they cute? Kind of the binary system, like, would you or wouldn't you, if given the opportunity, pardon me for being a little bit too bold, but would you or wouldn't you, based on that, meet them for, talk on the phone briefly, are they charming, even a little entertaining, cool, meet them for coffee, yes or no,
absolutely,
boom, done. Well, don't divulge a ton of personal information, you don't have a ton of yourself out there. It's time-consuming, but it's a lot safer.
Absolutely. And I mean, this friend of mine is a physician, and he says that most of the women that he's met online don't look like their pictures, so that he wants to go to their Facebook profiles to try to see if their pictures are consistent across the board and if they're trying to purport themselves to be someone they're not, because he claims that I spend so much time at the hospital. When I'm actually having my free time, I want to see what they really look like. So it's something to think about. But Jordan, I really appreciate all of your advice. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your story.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Of course. Have a good day now. All right, listeners, that was Jordan Harbinger talking to us about social hacking and online dating. We are going to play a bit of music and then come back with Jason Harley. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. A couple months ago, we had my good friend, couples therapist, and PhD candidate at UCLA, Jason Harley, with us to talk about couples dynamics. And I've been dying to have him on the show again, and we were presented with the opportunity this week because there was a really interesting article in the New York Times talking about children having sex in their parents' homes. And growing up with my parents, who I would consider to be pretty permissive, they still were slightly protective of me. And I can tell you that when my boyfriend came to visit me and spent time at my house, my parents certainly would not have allowed me to have sex with him in our home. I did. Sorry, Mom and Dad, if you're listening. But it's really interesting to think about the dynamics between parents and children. And I can tell you that my parents once told me, when they caught my boyfriend and I making out in our house, that they said to me, "Jessica, we did not raise you to have these values." So, Jason, welcome. Talk to me. Tell me what you think about this.
Well, it's good to be here again. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
This is a tough area, I think, when you're looking at some of these issues, especially with teenagers. Teenagers are going to want to have sex. It's a natural biological function.
Of course.
And the part of the parents is to teach them what are the right values, when and when not to engage in sexual activity, I think, is a real big issue for parents or anything.
Yeah.
But allowing them to be sexual in the house, it does appear, I would think, that to many parents that would appear as permitting their teenagers to have sex.
Uh-huh.
And where most parents would like to just not know about it.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Jason, do you think that this is really an enlightened view? I don't think either one's really good. I mean, one is saying, yes, go have sex, do it, you know, we're all for it. The other view is saying, I want to ignore it, not talk to you about it, not communicate with you about a subject that's really sensitive, important, and could have major consequences for their emotional and physical well-being.
Well, there's got to be a middle ground there, where as parents, we talk to our children about sexual activity, what it means, why it's there, what are the pros and cons, the consequences of it. And, you know, a lot of times we focus on the STDs, we don't talk about pregnancy or vice versa. But on the other hand, too, when you're in that article that you mentioned, you know, they're talking about, well, it shows what a good relationship can be like. You know, they had that one instance of the kid that actually lived with them for like a year, I think, her boyfriend did while she was in high school. And the mother said, well, this is a good model for my younger daughter of what a monogamous relationship is like. I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Oh, yeah. No, I completely disagree with that. I mean, I sort of subscribe to this Jeffersonian view of a separation between church and state. I definitely subscribe to that. But I don't know if I subscribe to the Jeffersonian-esque view of separation between parents and the bedroom, because I think turning a blind eye to this issue is problematic. And I agree with you that it's not necessarily the ideal monogamous relationship. I mean, what do two 17-year-old kids know about love and sacrifice and compromise? I don't think that's an appropriate means by which to teach your child about monogamy.
Right. So are you suggesting that 17-year-olds shouldn't have sex?
No, I think 17-year-olds should be having sex. I think they should be doing it, but safely, in a comfortable environment. and should be open to talking to their parents about it. Whether I just don't think the parents should necessarily be like, okay, come and spend the night at my home. I think that when, I mean, I don't have children, Jason, but when I do have kids one day, I want my kids to be able to talk to me about sex. And it's given that I study it, it might be a little weird and they might think that I'm analyzing them. But I think that I don't want, you know, my future children to be having sex. I would not let my future children's boyfriend spend the night at my home knowing full well that they're going to be spending the night in my child's bedroom. I would have them spend the night in a guest room. I think that's appropriate. If they're going to spend the night, if they have to spend the night, then they can spend the night in the guest room.
And they will try to sneak down the hall into the
house. I'm sure that they will, but I have ears that can sense everything.
And that's part of the lure for teenagers, is the illicit act of it, of doing it when the parents are home in the parents' bed or something to that effect.
That's terrible. I cannot imagine. I did not, Mom, Dad, I never had sex in your bed. I will just say that.
There's a respect issue, I think, for children and their parents, that these are not, it's not appropriate in the home. Of course, that changes. You know, you get married or you have a long-term committed relationship and you bring that person home and you're an adult. You expect to be able to stay in the room.
Of course.
And that's an issue with some parents, even when you're an adult. You know, you don't do this under my house unless you're married. You know, I guess it depends on each parent, but I think the ultimate thing that parents have to think about is, all right, am I teaching my kid properly about what sex is, what it means, what it does, what the consequences of it are, emotional and physical?
Absolutely.
And are they having, if they do engage in this, are they doing it properly and in a safe, respectful manner? And then also that they should respect the parent as, you know, you don't do it in my house, at least that I know about.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to know about that you're doing it in my house. I want to know that you're doing it, but not that you're doing it in my house.
You know, when I taught high school, we used to give out condoms for a while. Uh-huh. And every year they would ask me, do you want to do that, Mr. Harley? Do you want to give out condoms? I'm like, I don't want to know who's having sex.
Yeah.
I don't want to give them out. I don't want them to be coming back to me every day and thinking, man, these people are getting more action than I am.
No, that's true. But I can tell you that, like, in the Ash Center, I'm really glad that there are condoms, which is the Student Health Center at UCLA. I'm really glad to see that there are condoms available to students, because
sure,
we should be promoting safe sex behavior. It's important for us to be telling kids that if you're going to be doing it, as my grandfather told my mother when she was a teenager, if you can't be smart, be safe. So, you know, I think that sort of translates into how we talk to our kids about sex. And what do you think is the best way for parents to talk about sex in a healthy way with their kids? Because a lot of parents and kids don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think it needs to start very early as part of this is nature, right? I mean, we watch television shows about animals and we see them mating, and so, you know, humans do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends, 8-year-old kid, after watching years of documentaries on the Animal Channel, turned it to his parents and said, do humans mate too?
Yeah.
And it dawned on him, right, that that's what I am. So I think then you have a healthy understanding if it's always part of the, not that it's always being talked about, but if it's just an open part of the conversation of this is what sexual activity is, I think then it becomes not a taboo. I think the issue that's missed a lot, and when you see these abstinence campaigns in schools or the safe sex campaigns in schools, is the emotional aspect of it.
Sure.
What does it mean to give your body to somebody else's body? Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen when that stops?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, every 16-year-old girl thinks that this is going to be the love of her life, and she's going to marry this guy.
Uh-huh, yeah. And then they're done that.
Yeah, and we know that it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be sure and secure enough in ourselves. I think we need to teach our children enough of a personal sort of self-esteem that they don't have to feel they have to jump in the bed with every guy because he likes me, or every girl because I'm going to be cool if I have sex with a lot of girls.
Yeah, no, I think it does relate to self-esteem. And I talk to a lot of women about, you know, why they have sex with men, and they do it because they want him to like them. And I think that that's a problem. And I think a lot of young women don't have the self-esteem and the self-worth to say, you know, I want to have sex with somebody because I want to be intimate with them. But I don't think that 16-year-olds really understand intimacy very well. But that only comes with experience and time. And usually around 16, 17, that's when most kids are starting to really experiment sexually.
Right. And and you hope that there's going to be at least some level of intimacy there, because in some cases they're not.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's a big trend in schools these days where girls are performing oral sex because they think, oh, at least I'm still a virgin.
Yes.
But then there's no, they're not receiving any pleasure themselves.
Of course. No, absolutely.
So the whole act is based on pleasing the man and having the man like me, mm-hmm. or in this case, a boy, and then that generates that self-esteem issue of, oh, he'll like me if I do this for him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's constant in the media and in what's going on and what's being talked about because parents are talking about it. And so as good parents really need to counter that strongly and say, this is what makes a good person, not that you're cute and pretty and wear nice clothes, that you're smart and educated and have a good sense of self and know when you should share yourself with somebody else.
Absolutely. And Jason, on the point of oral sex as a form of sexuality, I always find it interesting that women claim, oh, I've just had oral sex, I'm still a virgin. I think oral sex, to be honest with you, is almost as intimate as intercourse, to be honest.
Right. I think, you know, many people are just taking their cue from Bill Clinton. But
he did not have sexual relations with that woman. That's right. I forgot. I keep forgetting this. Thank you for telling me again.
You're definitely right on that. And many women, you know, the women who I know that do have the self-esteem that don't want to just go out and leave a man will understand that aspect of it. Because really what's happening, and I think in the schools, what I've seen from people that have come talk to me is, you know, oh, this guy's like, I relented. Okay, fine. I'll do oral sex, but I won't do anything else. And the guy is fine with that because he's getting exactly what he wants.
Yeah, he doesn't have to do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Jason, can I ask you something? I talked about an issue earlier today, and I wanted your opinion about it. There was an article recently that came out by some researchers in Arizona about individuals having sex with their partners after they divorce them, and talking about how there might be a benefit to this because there's been a void in attachment after the divorce, and people can fill that attachment with sex. And I wanted to get your feedback because I was so upset by this article, thinking to myself, you're telling individuals to enter back into a sexual relationship with a person that they no longer want to be married to.
I heard this comedian once. He said, I don't understand why people divorce and then remarry the same person they divorced. It's like going into the refrigerator and grabbing the milk cart and saying, oh, this is bad. I'll put it back. Maybe it'll be better tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I, you know, there is, it's funny. We've seen with things like if there's a death in the family or there's a, some sort of emotional event that maybe immediately afterwards there's a desire to have intimacy. And oftentimes couples, even like right as they're breaking up, you know, desire that intimacy. But I think the emotional aspect, as you're saying, to go back to that later on, because, oh, I can't find anybody and sex with my husband was comfortable and intimate enough for me, that's not a good reason to get back with somebody.
Yeah, I think you're totally spot on, Jason. I couldn't agree with you anymore.
Well, great.
We're both in agreement. The University of Arizona researchers are wrong. We're going to do our own study about it. We've got absolutely. We've got our own PhDs. We can do it. All right, y'all.
We can do it.
Jason, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Great. Thanks so much. All right, lovers and friends. That was Jason Harley, our couples therapist and relationship expert. I'm going to play a bit of music and then be right back. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just talked to couples therapist Jason Harley about sex and parents. So now we're going to end with my dating advice for the week. It's short and sweet, but your skirt should not necessarily be. Ladies, you want to dress how you want to be treated. If you're going to walk around in short skirts with low-cut shirts, you're not going to be treated in a way that you want to be. Wear something smart, sexy, provocative, but not too suggestive. Remember, you want a guy to be looking at more than just what's below your neck, but what's above your neck too. He should be listening to your voice, looking at your eyes at all times. And if you want him to treat you like a date that he wants to see at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to go for a hike, you don't want to necessarily be the girl that he wants to take home at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's my dating advice for the week. Remember, y'all, don't fake it.